Do you ever wonder where creativity comes from? Perhaps it has to do with being made in the image of God. What do I mean? I have very logical reasons for believing in things that logic and reason can never teach me. It's kind of ironic, but the more complexity science finds in life, the less likely becomes the whole scenario in theory they use to explain its origin. The really amazing thing is that quantum physics shows that nature, at its most fundamental level, strains human credulity and knowledge in ways biblical faith never does. Hi, Cliff Goldstein here. Welcome to the program. You know, a while back, I had some workmen at my house. And I have a 105-pound German Shepherd, and I didn't want the dog sniffing around and barking and scaring the workmen. So I tried to put her outside on a leash, and I have this corkscrew that I screwed in the ground, and I had the dog on the under end of the leash, and I'm corkscrewing the thing in the ground. Well, a 105-pound dog, she takes off. She takes off running, and she's running, and boom! My finger gets caught in the corkscrew, and bah, right then and there, I could just feel I just broke my finger, okay? It just sort of hung there really disgustingly crooked. Okay, now, I kind of walk into my house, and I actually felt so much pain for a minute or so, I felt kind of faint. Okay, so all right, so it's not like I had a heart attack. It's a broken finger, for crying out loud. You go to the doctor, and he puts it in a splint, and you get it fixed. Big deal. Well, the problem was it was a little more complicated than that because I was scheduled to fly out of the country in a few hours. And so there is no way that I had the time to be able to go to the emergency room, go to a doctor, get my finger worked on. So, and you know, I had this trip planned for a year. And I mean, it would sound kind of wimpy. You know what I'm saying? Oh, I broke my finger. I got to cancel the trip. So I said, I'm going to go anyway. Okay. So my wife taped up my finger and off I went on not necessarily my so merry way. I mean, you try carrying luggage around with a newly broken finger. Okay. But anyway, I get to the airport. I'm in the airport. And I'm reading the New Yorker magazine. It's one of my favorite reads. It's kind of left-wingy and all that, but very well written, very well done, well edited. The copy editing of the New Yorker is literally legendary among English speakers. If you want to, whatever you think of the politics, you want to read good writing, good editing, read the New Yorker magazine. Anyway, I was reading an article in the New Yorker by neurologist Oliver Sacks, the late neurologist, and he talked about, it was very strange because he talked about the time he almost had a mystical experience listening to a Monteverdi concert. Now, I have to say, that struck me as very strange. I mean, how does somebody have a mystical experience listening to music? I mean, unless the guy was on acid or something when he was listening to it, it just, that didn't make sense to me. But it caught my curiosity because, you know, I am I'm a fairly broad-minded person, but, you know, I guess broad-minded, and I'm well-read enough to know I don't know much about anything. And yet I wondered, how does somebody have a mystical experience listening to music? Now, trust me, I understand about mystical experiences. Hey, you get on YouTube sometime and Google, look up Cliff Goldstein conversion story or something, and you will see what I'm talking about. But anyway, I was curious. You know, from music, though, how does somebody have a mystical experience from music? Anyway, it struck me as very strange. But anyway, I'm going on, and then I'm thinking, you know, he was listening to classical music. Maybe I'll try to listen to some classical music. But me, classical music? I mean, you got to be kidding me. I mean, at that time, I was 56 years old, and pretty much my whole life, I had no interest in music at all. I mean, I grew up in the 70s and listened to some of that headbanging stuff that you did back then. And I went to a few rock concerts, but I really didn't care about music. And classical music, oh my goodness. It always sounded the same to me. It just sounded like the kind of stuff you hear at the end of old movies and so on. And it all sounded alike anyway. But anyway, whatever it was, I just decided I was gonna try to get into some classical music a little bit. I was gonna listen to some. And on a whim, and I don't know, maybe to distract myself from my aching finger, I downloaded onto my iPhone some Beethoven. Some of his symphonies and, well, I guess maybe you could say some of his hit singles. That would have been hit singles. Moonlight Sonata for Elise, or however you pronounce it. Beethoven's Descent into Madness. The one piece called Trouble in Vienna. And as I said, some of the symphonies. And you know, it was amazing. It was like the switch suddenly clicked on, and I just love the stuff. I loved it. It was like, I can't get enough of it. It's like a whole new realm of existence, like a fifth dimension opened up to me. You know, I have no idea how this music works, but who cares, you know? I sit in my office sometimes, and people complain. They tell me to turn it down, and I'm blasting this classical music. And at times, it can excite some emotions in me. It really can. That's something that, well, I know Led Zeppelin's Livin', Lovin' Maid or Bungle in the Jungle just can't evoke in me. I guess maybe you have to be a classical music lover to know what I'm talking about. I mean, I have no idea how it works. I have no idea what these people do or how they do it. All I know is that I find it amazing. And recently, I got a course. I wanted to learn more about it. I got a course from the Great Courses series called How to Understand and Listen to Great Music. And the teacher's name is Robert Greenberg, and he was a great teacher. But in the end, the course was a bit too heavy for me, and it was just a little too... He assumed a knowledge of music that I didn't have, and I decided I'm going to forget about trying to understand it. I'm just going to enjoy it. Anyway... And now I'm into classical music. I'm constantly downloading. It's starting to get expensive. I see something, I just download it. iTunes is dangerous. You know, just boom, boom, boom. Anyway, a while back, I was listening to something that just so blew my mind. It was from Brahms. It was Brahms' Second Symphony in D, Opus 73-1, Allegro non troppo. Wow, that's pretty impressive, isn't it? Now, I'm just reading off of what was on the track. D, I guess, is like D major, D minor. Opus, I guess, is work. One is for the first movement. Allegro non troppo? I mean, come on, I didn't know an allegro non troppo from a caramel frappuccino. I finally looked it up, and it said fast, but not too fast. But anyway, putting all that aside, Brahms' Second Symphony, first movement. I listened to it, and I had one of the most beautiful aesthetic experiences I ever had. I listened to that thing, and it just seemed to me one of the most incredible of human creations. And as I'm listening to this, I'm marveling. How can a human being have thought something like this up? How did the man come up with all this, all the notes, all the music, all the instruments, planning each thing in its time and its place? How did this come out of somebody's brain? Where did this come from the protoplasm in the guy's head? See, you know, I'm a writer. I'm a creative person, so I earn my living. And I admit it sometimes. I sit down to work, bing, 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 bang, bang, I'm banging, and seems like out of nowhere, images, expressions, ideas rise up somewhere from inside me. Where? I mean, I don't have a clue. Well, I don't have a clue. Somewhere in my head. But I mean, I sit there with my finger on the keys, and at times, these things just come up that I never thought about before. Where did this stuff come from? You know, how does it get there? I know that years ago, Friedrich Nietzsche had written about this amazing ability for human beings to create. And in a recent book about imagination, author Jonathan Lehrer wrote this. This is kind of fascinating. William James described the creative process as a seething cauldron of ideas, where everything is fizzing and bobbing about in a state of bewildering activity. I love that. For the first time, we can see the cauldron itself, the massive network of electrical cells that allow individuals to form new connections between old ideas. We can take snapshots of thoughts and brains. That's a crock, but I will come back to that. We can take snapshots of thoughts and brain scanners and measure the excitement of neurons as they get closer to a solution. The imagination could seem like a magic trick of matter. New ideas emerging from thin air, but we are beginning to understand how the trick works. Well, you know, come on. I mean, you can map the brain. You could see it work. You could see the neurons firing. You can maybe measure all the chemicals. You can do all the stuff. We might be able to parse and analyze everything that goes on in the human brain. But I believe all the brain scans in the world up to this point couldn't explain how Brahms wrote one note of his symphony, much less the entire one. You know, anyway, maybe this was my version of a mystical experience such as what Oliver Sacks got from Monteverdi. I don't know. But as I listened to it really hit me with Brahms' Second Symphony. As I'm listening to this thing, and I'm just mad, how did this guy come up with this stuff? It suddenly hit me that whatever being made in the image of God meant, it had to include creativity, transforming thoughts into Brahms' Second Symphony. I'm convinced demanded a divine link somewhere. Now, please, you know, I'm not saying that's something supernatural, as if God or angels supernaturally came down and inspired him or anyone else in the creative process like that. I don't think I'm not talking about regular creativity, but I think instead the supernatural aspect came in the beginning in what was when God first created human minds to begin with. You know, think about this for a minute. Think about Brahms' Second Symphony. I mean, an acoustical engineer could explain everything about the sounds, the decibels, the wavelength, the pitch of music, and all that. A physiologist could explain everything about how the neurons fired as I listened, or to the neurotransmitters that left, what went from, you know, or could explain everything about the eardrum, the hammer, the anvil, the nerves from the ear to the brain and all that. A neurologist could explain everything about the neurons that fired and the neurotransmitters that went from one cleft to another. Yet everything that science could explain or could ever explain would never get to what really mattered, which was why that music so powerfully moved me. Science's dogmatic materialism can't explain that element of reality any more than shining a flashlight in a dark room could reveal somebody's dream. I got a quote here. I think I've quoted it before on here from a chemist, Michael Polanyi. And he said, current biology is based on the assumption that you can explain the process of life in terms of physics and chemistry. And of course, physics and chemistry are both to be represented ultimately in terms of forces acting between atomic particles. So all life, all human beings, all works of man, including Shakespeare's sonnets and Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, and I would stick in Brahms' Second Symphony, are also so to be represented. The ideal of science is to replace all human knowledge by complete knowledge of atoms in motion. I'm sorry, folks, but Brahms' Second Symphony, sure, there are atoms in motion there, but there's a whole lot more going on than just that. Here's a quote from Leon Weisslitter. Imagine a scientific explanation of a painting, a breakdown of Chardon's cherries into pigments that compromise them, and a chemical analysis of how their admixture produces the subtle and plangent tonalities for which they are celebrated. Such analysis will explain everything except what needs most explaining. The quality of the beauty that is our reason for our contemplation of the painting. You see, there's a level of reality here that atoms alone don't explain. Let me read you another quote. This was from a physicist, Franz Wilczek. When and if we have found and understood the complete irreducible laws of physics, we shall certainly not know the mind of God. Hawking's to the contrary. We'll not even get much help in understanding the mind of slugs, which is about the current frontier of neuroscience. You know, it's no wonder a while back a well-known atheist named Thomas Nagel wrote this fascinating book. I really recommend it. It's called Mind and Cosmos. Why the material neo-Darwinian conception of nature is almost certainly false. And the thing is, Nagel is an atheist. He's not a Christian, okay? And I think he even believes in evolution. He's just saying, hey, the Darwinian thing isn't going to work. And for Nagel, for him, the point is obvious. Is that that model, this materialistic-only model, the model that we got drummed in us, hammered into us by the hegemons of the scientific industrial complex and all the rest, that model of just pure material things alone cannot explain human consciousness. It just has failed miserably. Nagel writes, "My skepticism is not based on religious belief or on a belief in any definite alternative. It is just a belief that the available scientific evidence, in spite of the consensus of scientific opinion," oh, that's important, "in spite of the consensus of scientific opinion, does not in this matter rationally require us to subordinate the incredulity of common sense." In other words, hey, all the scientists might tell us, all the big names, the best and the brightest, they all tell us that, but I'm sorry, it doesn't work. It just strains common sense. And though I think I understood before listening to classical music that reality is so much greater than the narrow parameters of scientific materialism, Brahms' Second Symphony was almost an experience to me. It showed me, hey, my sense that it's greater is, I'm not off key. Here was an experience that, I'm sorry, you'll never convince me that that was nothing but atoms and chemicals. I'm sorry, but science's dogmatic materialism cannot be correct. I mean, I can't prove it's not correct any more than I can prove it is correct. Can't prove it. But now I want to lead you a famous or infamous quote from a well-known biologist. This quote is used and it's very powerful because the man's not saying anything that's not already known. He's just saying it very honestly. And he's talking about scientific materialism. Everything is just atoms in the void and nothing else is allowed. He says, listen to this. "Our willingness to accept scientific claims that are against common sense is the key to understanding the real struggle between science and the supernatural." Okay. "We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs." Wow. "We take the side of, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories. Because we have a prior commitment to materialism." See what he's saying? Yeah, we know the stuff is just so stories. We know the stuff is absurd, but we have a commitment to materialism, period. He goes on. this is even more fascinating. It's not that the methods and institutions of science compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, that we are forced to, by our a priori adherence to material causes, to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. In other words, he's saying, all right, look, we don't really even have a good reason for doing it. We're doing it anyway because we have a preconceived notion of material causes, and therefore that's how we're going to look at everything, no matter how silly or ludicrous or absurd it seems. And then he says, why does he do it? Moreover, that materialism is absolute because we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Whoa! I mean, this is what creationists and other people have been saying all along. Well, you're just a bunch of wacko creations. But here's a hardcore atheistic evolutionist. And what is he saying? He's not saying what wasn't already known. He just says it with an honesty and a forthrightness that is rare among scientists. I mean, which is basically he's saying, the sacred creed of naturalism, it's based on philosophy. It's based on culture. It's not based on anything in science. Nothing, he said, in the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a materialistic explanation of the phenomenal world. In other words, he's saying it's not science that does it. Instead, it's like, hey, we don't want anything divine. We don't want to even allow a divine foot in the door. So we are going to absolutely, even though we don't have any real good scientific reasons for it, we are going to make everything materialistic that way to keep out any possibility of the supernatural. Okay? Whew. You know, it's a purely philosophical argument that he's making here. And even it wouldn't be bad because it's such shabby philosophy as well. They don't want to allow a divine foot in the door. And again, he's saying it's not science that calls for that. It's cultural and social biases that do. Okay? Hardly the stuff of serious philosophical inquiry. Thus, anyway, the point here is materialism, a sacred assumption of science, arises from a philosophical commitment, the non-existence of the divine, that science itself can't even address. And in fact, already some scientists are questioning it anyway. They're saying, we really can't do that. But anyway, I'm deviating here a little bit. I want to come back to Brahms' Second Symphony, or to music in general, or to classical, or really just to the human ability to create. Where does this come from? How do we get it? Now, I don't think I can't be dogmatic about this, but I think like many others, I just don't think the present scientific spiel can answer that. Somehow I know when I'm creating, or I'm listening to Brahms, or I'm looking at something that somebody has created, I believe I'm being brought into a realm that includes the material, of course, but something that exceeds it. I truly believe that the answer to this is found in the idea that we are made in the image of God. You know, a lot of ink has been spilled over the centuries. What does it mean to be made into the image of God? And, you know, I'm not going to sit here in a few minutes left try to answer that question. But think about it. Humans are first told, or we're first told, the first idea that humans are made in the image of God appears in the first chapters of the Bible. And what is the role in those first chapters of the Bible that we see God primarily in? The first two chapters, what do we see God in? We see God in the role as creator. He's creating. He's taking something and making something. He's taking whatever there, however he did it. He's speaking things into existence. He's creating something that wasn't there before. The emphasis here is on his creative ability. The emphasis of him taking what is not there or and putting it there, or what was there, create, turning it into something else. And isn't, in a sense, isn't that what we as humans do when we create something? Brahms had a blank sheet of paper in front of him, I guess, and before long there are these lines and lines of musical notes and all the notes, whatever, and you got Brahms' Second Symphony, first movement, Allegro non troppo. I mean, isn't, you know, in a sense, it really didn't come out of nowhere. I mean, it all came out of his head, of course, but these musical notes didn't exist in his head as musical notes. Okay, there was something there mysteriously and out of his head. What was ever in there, it appeared on the paper, and the next thing you know, note after note, and the next thing you know, you got Brahms' entire Second Symphony. Somewhere in his head, somewhere, even if they could map it on a brain scan, that would not explain. Somewhere out of something greater than just hormones and neurons, Brahms' Second Symphony appears. A writer has a blank sheet of paper in front of him or her, or a blank computer screen, however. And before long, words, languages, themselves, something full of mystery, word, appear on the paper, perhaps something astonishingly beautiful. And how does that happen? Where do those words come from? They might have not even thought of this idea before. And it happens to me. I sit down and I'm typing. And where did this come from? Where did this idea come from that 2 seconds earlier? I never had it. How do they arise? Was it just chemicals and neurons and hormones firing that were somehow able to take something in me and suddenly have my fingers type away and convert them into sentences and paragraphs and eventually short stories, articles, or books? I don't know. It just doesn't compute. Just doesn't work. And a painter staring before a blank canvas that an hour, 2 hours, 3 days later, whatever, is filled with colors and strokes, whatever, you know, whatever the angles that he has turned into his unique creation. I'm sorry, brain cells alone, even trillions of them, created all those Van Gogh paintings? Sure. Brain cells were involved, but I don't think brain cells alone can explain them. Again, I don't know how. I don't know how or whatever, but I think in a very vague but very real way, our human ability to create is something that in a very real sense is an expression of what it means to be made in the image of God. In the image of the ultimate creator. That certainly makes better sense, I think, than the idea that somehow by random acts of genetic mutation, we can account for things like Brahms' Second Symphony, Opus 73, number 1, Allegro non troppo. Next time you create something, think that's what it means to be made in the image of God.